Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson, and this essay is part one in your guide to this year's constitutional cases from the Supreme Court. This essay and part two following thumbnail the 10 most important constitutional cases in the Supreme Court's October 2022 term, which ended on June 30, 2023. Each episode relates the gist of each case and whether it was based on constitutional originalist grounds or on some other factors. The mass media often say that the Supreme Court has a 6-3 conservative majority. For reasons I've detailed in other essays also available on the Independence Institute website, this statement isn't accurate. And this year's cases further confirm that it isn't accurate. On the contrary, these cases, which otherwise have mixed results, still display the liberal judicial pattern of aggressively striking down state laws and regulations while refusing to keep Congress within constitutional limits. To understand why this happens, you have to know how to count to five. Five is the number necessary to form a majority on the 9-member bench. There are three liberal activists, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. To reach the majority of five, they must persuade just two of their colleagues to vote with them. But on the other side, there's only one staunch originalist, Clarence Thomas. For him to prevail, he must persuade not two, but four of his colleagues to vote with him. The five in the middle follow several different judicial philosophies. They all take into account the original meaning of the Constitution. But they also favor certain judicial notions that were spun by liberal majorities during the 20th century. These include the incorporation doctrine, which is mentioned below, and the notion that courts should stretch the law if necessary to defer to Congress, and also acceptance of the cases by which liberal majorities substantially rewrote the Constitution in the late 1930s and 1940s. One last introductory point. Some of this year's important cases weren't constitutional decisions. Instead, they interpreted specific laws. In this category were first Biden versus Nebraska, the student loan case, which was touted as a conservative victory, and Allen versus Milligan, which struck down a Republican reapportionment plan for the Alabama legislature. That was proclaimed as a liberal victory. So those were cases interpreting statutes. The cases considered in these two installments either interpreted the Constitution, or if they did interpret statutes, had major constitutional implications. The first case is Tyler versus Hennepin County. On its face, this unanimous decision looks like a conservative victory. The court held that a property owner's loss of $25,000 in a tax sale foreclosure violated the rule in the Constitution's Fifth Amendment that government can't seize property without compensation. But closer examination shows the case isn't entirely what it seems to be. First, Chief Justice John Roberts' opinion applied a liberal 20th century constitutional theory long criticized by many serious historians and constitutional scholars. This is the incorporation doctrine that I just mentioned. The incorporation doctrine is that when the 14th Amendment was adopted in 1868, it not only imposed explicit rules mentioned in the amendment on the states, but it also somehow imposed additional unmentioned rules on the states as well. Additionally, the Tyler case makes it clear that the justices feel empowered to interfere more in state property law, even though property law is a field the Constitution reserves to state rather than federal control. And thirdly, in a concurring opinion in the Tyler case, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Ketanji Brown Jackson pointed out that the $25,000 forfeiture could have been treated as an excessive fine in violation of the Eighth Amendment. In fact, the forfeiture is more naturally classified as a fine than as a property taking. So why didn't the court treat it as a fine? I think part of the answer is that the state forfeiture in the Tyler case was bird feed compared to the penalties federal agencies impose. For example, in Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency, discussed in the next installment, Justice Samuel Alito noted that the EPA could fine a property owner $65,000, and not on a one-time basis either, but $65,000 per day. Classifying a one-time $25,000 state penalty as an excessive fine would have invited long overdue challenges to the brutal punishments imposed by federal agencies. But the Supreme Court's majority is cautious. Perhaps they didn't want to encourage such challenges. Next case, 303 Creative versus Alanis. In 303 Creative versus Alanis, the court also applied the incorporation doctrine to reach its result. Aside from that, however, it's a clear victory for what the media call conservatives and what the rest of us call the Constitution. 303 Creative is a Colorado web design company owned by Lori Smith. State authorities wanted to force her to use her talents to design for same-sex weddings. However, as a Christian, Ms. Smith believes, in accordance with traditional Christian, Jewish, and Muslim views, that same-sex weddings contradict God's law. The issue was whether the state could force her to violate those beliefs. However, the court's decision was not based on the First Amendment's protections for religion, but on its protection for free speech. Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion ruled that the state couldn't force her to deliver a message of which she disapproved. The vote should have been unanimous, but it was 6-3. One reason it wasn't unanimous is because the parties and the court mischaracterized the case. Ms. Smith's design work is not protected by the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech. It's protected by the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of the press. You can see a more complete analysis of this point in my article for the Federalist Society blog, which you can find on the Independence Institute website. The third case in this installment is Holland versus Brackeen. Holland versus Brackeen was a huge liberal victory. As many readers know, the Constitution's Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, has been stretched by the courts unmercifully. It was originally an authorization to regulate trade and a few related activities. It's become a license for Congress to regulate the entire economy. And yet, the ruling in Holland versus Brackeen stretched the Commerce Clause even further. Through Justice Amy Coney Barrett, a 7-2 majority held that Congress could employ its power to, quote, regulate commerce with the Indian tribes, end quote, to govern an activity that has nothing whatever to do with commerce, and that is the placement of Indian children in adoptive and foster homes. Justice Barrett's opinion and the concurrence by Justice Gorsuch are among the most confused Supreme Court opinions issued in recent years. Indeed, the court, in an opinion by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, issued just a few days later, seemed to repudiate some of the language in Holland versus Brackeen from just a few days earlier. Supporters of the Constitution often express the hope that the Supreme Court will trim Congress's unlimited Commerce Clause pretensions. They have been disappointed again and again. Holland is the next disappointment, is the latest disappointment. In the next installment, we'll cover seven more cases. I'm Rob Nadelson. Thanks for listening.